Ever try to get into one of Advertising Week's amazing sessions and suddenly hear that the room is at capacity? Now you can still experience it in real time. Listen to that keynote or panel as a live audio stream in the Advertising Week app, powered by Live365. Advertising Week Radio features sessions, podcast clips, curated music, and more, both during the shows and year-round. Visit aw.live365.com for easy access instructions. Live365, the world's audio.
Welcome to Great Minds, and this is one of a very rare number of returns that we've had. The return of my old pal, Rob Prasmark. Rob was on with us a year or two ago. I think it was last year, Rob. And since then, your best-selling book, The Olympics Don't Take American Express, has come out. It's a wonderful read and really, as the title suggests, traces the birth of mega sport sponsorships. We did talk in our first episode, Rob, about sort of your career path, but I really wanted to dig in deeper here on the book. I was thrilled to know that there is indeed a part two. I thought it might be like History of the World, part one. It may take quite a while to get to part two, but here it is coming hot on the heels of part one. And it's just a great read. I'm so glad to have you back here, Rob. So thanks for doing this.
Thanks, Matt. You know, it took 35 years to write, if I may hint this, the first version. When you write a book, you don't know what the response is going to be and who the audience will appeal to. And I've had, you know, three buckets of responses. One is people love it, that know me, know the movement, whatever, much like yourself, and know the characters that are in the book. You got a number of people that came out of the woodwork I've never met before in my life, who have said that, you know, they're salespeople or they're in the business, young people who enjoyed it and thanked me for that, which is terrific. And you get a couple of grumpy grams, you know, they didn't like the way that they were perceived. And in one case, I won't mention who it is, was complaining about how I characterized him. And I said, look, at part two, this is the cover to part two, is coming out. I'll give you 10,000 words. You can correct your story. I never heard from him again. But if anybody has a problem, I'm happy to give them, I don't know how many pages 10,000 words is anyway, but I'll give them 10,000 words. But it's been a real fun thing, Matt, reconnecting with a lot of folks. And part two, everyone wanted to know about part two. And I hadn't thought about writing part two, but I threw that in as a fun thing on the book. So I began to write part two. And part two goes from 2010 through 2024. And the subtitle is Innovators, Imitators, and Idiots. So it'll be a fun read. Again, much to the spirit of part one, it's a fun, quick, anecdotal read. And that's the spirit I want to go forward with.
You have become the Hemingway of the sports marketing industry. So let's first take just half a step back. And we touched on this lightly in our first conversation, but let's go a little deeper. The process of writing a book, not something I've ever done. I think this was your first effort to that end. Not an easy mountain to climb.
No, and people ask me about my memory. And, you know, I've got an okay memory. And, you know, it took me 35 years to write this thing. And early on, before there was the internet, and before we had Microsoft Word, I would sit on long airplane flights and take notes on big yellow pads of paper and save articles. And I would dump it in a big box in a storage unit. So when the internet came around, it really helped me out because I saved every email since 1994, every presentation, everything. So it was very easy to go back and recreate those lessons or those stories because I just have to go back into my files and pull it all out. So that was labor of love. You know, along the way, I would have what I call my kitchen cabinet. People I trust would look over my shoulder and read it for accuracy and stuff like that. And that really helped. And A long time ago, I met this young lady who also helped me edit, who had a fierce sense of humor. And so there's a lot of humor in it. It's a lot is attributed to her, not so much me. In fact, I had to rein her in a couple of times. But it was a process. And then selecting a publisher is another thing because it's self-published, but it was good. What I also did, Matt, was sections that I knew were important. I would send advanced copies of their section. Mitt Romney's a great example. Okay. I worked with Mitt in Salt Lake City, and he's got a lot of stuff on his, in his head to working on as being a senator and now retiring. But a year ago, I sent him his stuff and I said, what do you think, Mitt? And, he wrote back, this is a hoot. You got to go with it. Sent it to, I never heard back from Hugh Broth, never heard back from Jerry Jones, but I gave him an opportunity to respond. And then Casey Wasserman loved his part, which was a lead up to chapter 10 or 11. So that and a few other folks. So that helped me to make Michael Payne was another one. And Rick, that was a former USOC CMO, I sent him his part. And I said, hey, is this accurate? And they all had changes, usually to how I would describe them is the real thing. But I the product, when it got out the door, I felt real confident that it was a solid product. I had a bunch of lawyers look at it. I mean, it's, especially when you use the title, the Olympics don't take American Express. You want to make sure you don't get a cease and desist from somebody. And I got cleared because of all that. So it's not easy to write a book, but it's fun when it gets out the door.
It sure is. And I think unlike so many books that we read by industry leaders, often they sort of have a expanded vision, shall we say, of their own roles. You did not. Your descriptions and the stories you tell and your role in creating and shaping those stories was deadly accurate. And I thought your take on a lot of the players in the industry was very, very fair, almost kind. And it was not meant to be sort of a gossip type of book, but rather to simply tell the story of the evolution of the modern business, which you did brilliantly. So let's talk a little bit about some of the stuff. We're on the edge of the next Olympic Games. And let's go back and talk about, there you go with your Paris 2024 shirt. Let's go back and talk about those early days at ISL. Horst Dassler, that really was the most important evolution of the entire global business.
Yeah, and there is interesting, the book generated some interest from people that predated me. They have their own version of how all this came together. My version is when I joined ISL in 1985, the top program in ISL was just coming together. And my role wasn't to help put it together in terms of rights acquisition. My job was to go out and sell it to the marketplace. ISL and IOC back in the day really did know what kind of job that would be. And they were so far ahead of themselves in terms of global marketing. Nowadays, people kind of shrug at global marketing. That must have been a slam dunk. But back then, you had Coke and you had Kodak. Remember Kodak? And then you had Adidas. They were the only three global brands. So when I would approach a McDonald's or approach some of the other companies, they would say to me on a global idea in 1985, they go, you're not doing your research, kid. Because we have three stores in Moscow doesn't make us a global brand, meaning McDonald's. And so that was the biggest difficult part of this, was to sell something way ahead of its time. And if it wasn't for Visa to come in and do it, I got to tell you, I'm not quite sure the top program would have existed. Now, some may have said that would have been a good thing, but the top program may have not existed if it wasn't for, Visa and John Bennett, who has the vision at the time.
So let's take a quarter of a step back. 84 Olympics in LA, bid out 7 years before 1977.
Correct.
A year after Montreal, the 1976 Summer Games.
Correct.
No one on the planet other than Los Angeles and Tehran as correct. I understand the story, bid for the 84 Olympics. The Olympics were considered undesirable. There was no money in the Olympics and amateur sports in general. The IOC, certainly a powerful club, but not a well-resourced club financially. Blue blazers, patches, a lot of pomp and circumstance, but no real money, no financial heft. The 84 games out of necessity, Peter Uberoth, Harry Usher, that team create a lot of what would become the foundation for the modern day business. Talk about the role of the LA games and how that led to the IOC saying, hey, wait a minute, there's something here, and the creation of the top program.
Well, let me say the fact that Peter Uberoth likes to say that there are only two cities bidding for the 84 games. Tehran, as you said, was correct, and Los Angeles. And Uberoth likes to tell the story that Tehran was actually going through a management change inside of the government, which they were, right? And so LA won it by default. They didn't want it. They gave it back to the IOC, and the IOC said, no. This is your game. So they shoved the ball back and they went out and found Peter Uberoth. What Peter did, which is the foundation of today, is create this concept of exclusivity. And nobody had heard of it. Well, Lake Placid had 300 sponsors, you know, paying like 10 grand, 15 grand each. And Peter goes, no, you know, we're going to sell exclusivity as a way of providing more value, more rights for more money. And that worked tremendously. You had Coke, I think $12 million, I think what they paid back in the day, which was a lot of money. You had the original AT&T, you had IBM, I mean, a big Mars. You had some big brands that Levi came forward, and he showed that the model would work with a lot of nail biting going on. And he turned probably a $250 million profit, which stayed in America. But what this, as the story was told to me, was that when Coca-Cola thought they acquired global rights for $12 million, when they showed up in Australia to start marketing with the LA Games and the Olympic marks, Australia said, no. You need to pay us some money, okay? A gentleman by the name of Gary Hight spent years of his life running around the world signing up deals. And the way, again, the story was told to me, Gary went to Samranch, who went to Dassler, and said, if you organize a global program, we'll buy it, because we cannot continue to spend so much time and so much money aggregating all these NOCs. And that gave credence. So again, Coke signed, they were technically the first to become a global partner, and they were a bellwether sponsor. So from Coke, we got Kodak, and then FedEx actually was number three. And then we got Visa, and the cornerstone of that is the Olympics don't take American Express, which was a right that they negotiated for in their contract. But Peter really showed the IOC that this could work globally.
Okay, so let's take half a step back here, because we're throwing around a lot of terms and things that you and I take for granted, but not everyone may know. So the 84 Games sponsor in that category, Visa, critical to the whole thing. When did Amex get shoved out and Visa come in? And I know John Bennett just passed. I know he was a dear friend of yours, a seminal figure. But talk about that transition from Amex to Visa, and then I want to set what the NOCs are, what the IOC, and how it all works, because not everybody knows all this stuff.
The 1984 games, actually, the sponsor was American Express. So Peter Uberoth had a relationship with then CEO Jim Robinson. They did some great stuff in 84, the LA Games. They integrated Olympism into their commercials. Chariots of Fire had just come out. They tagged along on that one. It was terrific. And so we thought American Express was a logical choice for the initial top program, because American Express was an international brand. They weren't a global brand. They were an international brand. There's a difference. And they did not want to buy the entire package that we were offering. They were also being led and consulted by a few folks who could gain to their advantage if the top program did not succeed. So there was a lot of cloak and dagger in those days behind this. And so in the end, I came to them and I said, you got to make a decision, American Express, on this. And they came all the way up at the top. Jim Robinson said, the Olympics need us more than we need the Olympics. Thank you. And with that, I got a little pissed off. And so I said, I'm going to sell it to somebody else. And they laughed me out the door. And one of their last comments is, what are you going to sell it to Visa, that ragtag group of banks? They can't even decide collectively what to have for lunch. I mean, they were tough in those days.
Okay, so let's ask a few questions here. Global versus international, you said not the same. Dig into that.
Well, global means, today's terminology, there are 210 National Olympic Committees called NOCs. And you really want a brand that operates in 180 of them versus maybe 220. Not everyone does business in Botswana, for example. Okay. But the concept of the top program, the Olympic program, total Olympic program, is all the funding goes to all the National Olympic Committees, not just the big ones. So Botswana has funds to train their athletes, to get their athletes to the games, to house them. I mean, that's the beauty of the top program. And international is when American Express came back to us, and it's in the book, their list of, I think they had 15, 16 countries of interest, but they were the have countries. They were Great Britain, West Germany at the time. You had Japan. You didn't even have China on the list. And so we said, no, we need your support to support the haves and the have-nots. And so money would go to Botswana or to the Fiji Islands and whatever. And that was the original intent of the top program, is to make sure that the little guys who could not afford to get athletes in the games, that they wouldn't become extinct because they weren't getting funding.
So creating a central pool, leveraging and uniting the 200 plus national Olympic committees. In America, it's the U.S. Olympic Committee, and then every other country similarly structured, and creating almost, let's call it, a central pool of money that would then be spread out. The big contributors, U.S., Japan, probably getting a larger share, but everyone, Peru, Botswana, Lesotho, everybody getting some of that global pool of revenue.
You got it right, man. And of $100 that would come in, 33% would go to the summer games. I think 17% would go to the winter games. And the rest of the pool, which was 50% of it, would be distributed across all the national Olympic committees. And to your earlier point, coming out of the 84 games, and the IOC did not get a dime of that profit that LA turned. It stayed in America. The IOC was almost bankrupt. I mean, I think they had, I was told, $3 million in the bank, which even in 85 is not a lot of money. And they were concerned that if a natural disaster were ever to hit, they're thinking earthquake and whatever, a pandemic is a great example. They never even thought of a pandemic back then. But what would happen if the IOC could not fund the games on their own? So it was also to create a war chest to make sure that the IOC could fund a games through bad times. The other thing they were concerned about, Matt, was the pooling of TV rights. But all the money was coming out of America. And what would happen if, ABC, NBC, CBS got together and said, hey, we're not going to pay these kind of rights fees. We're going to pay you, 10 cents on the dollar. The whole thing would crumble. So it was a make or break a time back in 85, 86, and 87.
Amazing stuff. Let's dig in a little deeper here to the decision by American Express to pass and to walk away. You mentioned Jim Robinson. There were some other seminal players there, Warner Canto, Jerry Welsh, who I always held in very high regard. I thought the work that Jerry did in 86 with the Statue of Liberty campaign, really in many ways the godfather of cause-related marketing. But that was one that you can argue pretty clearly with hindsight that they played wrong.
Yeah, Matt, I agree. And I realize now as I'm older, you sit back and go, wow, that was a big decision they had to make. And they made in their minds the wrong decision. And they didn't realize it until that first Visa commercial came out for Calgary and said, hey, make sure, if you go to the Olympic Games, make sure you bring a lot of time in your Visa card, because games happen like that and they don't take American Express. Well, that commercial shook the foundation of American Express cardholders to the point where American Express did their own survey and found that 66% of American Express cardholders thought the entire city of Calgary didn't take American Express. So there was a lot of back and forth between the IOC and American Express in those days. And American Express finally won the day a number of years later. They said, look, we admit we made a mistake. We admit it. If it ever becomes available, give us a call first. And they said that the problem we have with the tagline, the Olympics don't take American Express, is it's one thing for a company to use a sponsorship to promote their products. It's another thing to use a sponsorship to denigrate another company. That got into the IOC's head, and they went to Visa, and Visa took the high road, and they said, we will change, and they changed. But at that point, the horses were out of the barn, and it was one of the great stories, I think, in terms of making the right decision.
And so well told in the book, and really gives us the roadmap of the industry as it is today. Give us your sense, Paris is coming up. Give us your sense as to the growth trajectory. Who could have foreseen back then when the IOC was sitting with, you know, almost no money in the bank, no interest in bidding for the games, that little management change you referred to in Tehran was the Shah of Iran falling and the rise of the Islamic fundamentalist movement. So a unique characterization of management change, certainly. I like that. Talk about the growth. Who knew back then, Rob, when you started selling the top program in 85, what a business this has become?
Yeah, and it's also corporations have become more globalized. You could argue that there are only two, maybe three events that are truly global on the planet. Olympic Games, World Cup, they go head to head, two totally different offerings. And I've sold World Cup in the past as well. And then you probably got World Athletics. But, you know, it's tough to say that tennis is a global sport. It's very, and what is the offering for tennis on a global basis? F1. I mean, you could make an argument for F1. But the content hasn't kept up with demand. And that's the problem today. And it becomes a supply-demand price curve, where you got something like the Olympic Games and FIFA World Cup. Let's not forget about that monster. And you've got corporations who want to make a central decision to promote products and their imagery on a global basis. And there isn't that much product that's out there to really be global. So that, I think, fueled, Matt, a lot of the demand and why, you know, the top program gets, you know, $300 million every 4 years from corporations. But the demand, what we talk about Paris is going to be the Olympic coming out party, and it's going to slingshot Milan, but really Los Angeles, into a great, great place. What Los Angeles has to do is remind the world that this is not just about Los Angeles or Southern California. It's America's games. It's the world games. And they'll get into that after Paris, but it's going to be a really great coming out party in Paris, I think, for the Olympic movement and for the Olympic sponsors. Having said that, there are four, maybe five global partners that are leaving the top program after Paris. You got, which is a big hit, Toyota is leaving. And Toyota did such a great job of not only sponsoring the games, sponsoring broadcasts around the world, Paralympic games, it's supporting of athletes. And they're not coming back after Paris. You've got Intel not coming back. You've got Bridgestone, and you got Panasonic and Atos, which is the systems integrator. And if which I believe these all these reports are true, so the top program has got to reinvent itself and go back. But they've been saying that since the days of Peter Ueberroth. I saw Gene Sykes, who is chairman of the USOC, saying we've got to change the model. Well, I've heard about changing the model since 1985, but no one's been able to come up with a better model, a better mousetrap. So it's the for the Olympics, it's the value of the brand. They still have that amazing sound of alignment between Olympism and a brand and a corporation, and they'll continue to sell that. I mean, they went through the scandal of Salt Lake and survived, and there'll be more issues along the way. They went through the pandemics, Tokyo and Beijing did, 2022. So this brand really withstands pressure points and test points.
Interesting that so many of the Japanese global brands are leaving. Interesting.
And you know what? I got to tell you, Matt, they invested heavily in those games, the Japanese companies, Tokyo, and also you had Beijing and a lot of the Asian activities, and they were never able to reap the benefits of, all the, forget the rights money they paid the IOC, but remember they, all the plans and advertising and promotion, those budgets were spent and locked in, and they didn't get that money back. So I would tell you that I don't blame them. Bridgestone really never did much. No, I'll probably get emails from that one. And Panasonic over the years, and Intel did a little bit, but Toyota, they'll really miss that one.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. They did as you referenced, they did a wonderful job, not only with the Olympics, but with the Paralympics. So give us a little peek into chapter one, page one of part two.
Part one really was a challenge for me because there were a couple stories that didn't make it because the book was too big. And so I want to go back and pay homage to two previous stories. One is the great legendary David D'Alessandro of John Hancock. Really, he was an innovator. He was an innovator. And then World Cup and what Alan Rothenberg and Randy Bernstein did with World Cup 94, starting MLS, they were innovators. So I got to do a little correcting there. And then in some of the stories going forward aren't necessarily sports stories. In part one, we talked about Smithsonian, that's a passion of mine is doing what I call intellectual marketing, not just sports marketing. And so some of the folks I've run across that are it's still in play, projects I'm working on, which has nothing to do with sports, will be in there as well. So I don't want to give it away too early. The imitators and the idiot are part of this, but people make stupid mistakes, and they're never called out on it. They're never called out on it. So I'm going to get into this one story in particular that's still in progress. So by the time it's released, I will be able to say this. And to your thank you, I don't do too much damage. I don't really say it like it is. But I'll talk about lessons that I've learned.
Well, it's great. And I love this evolution of you as sort of a pundit slash elder statesman. But it's all based on a real foundation of accomplishment. And you've always been really gracious to me. I'm so grateful that after all these years that you and I are still friends. When I was 23 years old and the first director of the Sports Commission for New York City, you were really good to me, and I've never forgotten that. And I know a lot of years has passed because I'm getting ready to turn 60, and that means you're even older than me because you were older. You were much older than me then. You clearly remain older than me today. And Rob, I can't wait for part two. We will absolutely want to have you back. Let's get out and chase the little white ball into the woods and do some damage on the golf course. And I hope to see you soon, pal.
Yeah, thank you. And I just would like to add, if you have a moment, that last week we lost a dear friend of mine, a legend, John Bennett. And John Bennett was CEO or CMO of Visa. He was Tom Shepard, my business partner's boss. He worked with Jan Soderstrom, and they had the guts to say, we will take on the IOC project, the TOP program. And as long as you, kid, he used to call me a kid, I was 31, as long as you can deliver to me, the Olympics don't take American Express. And it was all verbal in those days. And I delivered it and he signed the contract, but he was 91. He had a good run and he did a lot of other things other than the Olympics. But if you read his obit, the Olympics were a major part of that. And his services on Friday, I'm flying up to attend it.
Great. Well, I'm glad you mentioned John, and a legend indeed. And let's stay in touch, pal. Hope to see you soon.
Great. Thanks, Matt.
Bye.